Before we get into today's lesson, which is number 14, we have a little bit still left on lesson 13, and I hope that you might have that. Burning the lesson number 13 to the very back, nearly the last page, page 6, we were discussing the making of vows or solemn promises. God's people from time to time did make various vows, solemn vows that were on their part an act of a voluntary sacrifice, something freely offered to God to invoke His favor or to express profound gratitude. We talked about that last week or last Wednesday night, but the most famous or the most, maybe the one remembered the most out of all of those vows is one that's actually given a name. That's called the Nazarite vow. And it's described in Numbers chapter 6, verses 1 through 21. And it's known as the Law of the Nazarite. I want to talk just briefly about it because it plays a significant part in the lives of several Bible characters. Usually, the Nazarite vow is one entered into by one voluntarily and made a commitment to God for a specific or a limited period of time. The Bible records three that are considered to have been Nazarites for a lifetime. First of those was Samson. You may remember the angel of the Lord appeared to Manoah's wife and said that Samson would be a Nazarite from the womb until the day of his death. So it was a lifetime thing for him. And, of course, all the conditions of a Nazarite applied to Samson. The second one was Samuel, where Hannah gave Samuel to the Lord. And the third one is thought to be a Nazarite vow. I can't find anywhere where it's specifically stated, but it's John the Baptist. And the reason for thinking that he was a Nazarite is based on Luke chapter 1, verse 15, where the Lord told Zacharias and Elizabeth that John the Baptist would have no wine or strong drink during his lifetime. So people have reasoned that this is sort of a top-level overview saying he was to be a Nazarite. In the New Testament, it's interesting, many believe that Paul took a Nazarite vow for a specific period of time based on Acts chapter 18 and verse 18, where Paul says that he had shorn his head at Cenchrea and he must go to Jerusalem, that he had a vow. And, of course, when you find the record of him arriving in Jerusalem and going to meet the brethren, taking four more charges with him to the temple, he goes through a rite of purification and making of offerings that appears to be in every way comparable to a Nazarite vow. This is very interesting because it describes a man with long hair in the New Testament. So was it a Nazarite vow? We don't know. It's never said specifically, but everything seems to fit. It's interesting, too, that the Nazarite vow could be for a man or a woman. That's specifically called out in Numbers chapter 6. And the conditions for both would be that they could not cut their hair, have nothing to do with the grape or the grapevine, and have nothing to do with any preventable, that is, something that could be a matter of choice, having contact with the dead, even if parents or siblings. Now, the vow could be interrupted. In other words, one could be a Nazarite and come in contact with the dead by accident. In other words, it was not preventable. The Bible describes one, a companion who falls beside you and dies, and that could be in a time of conflict, as and we're not given really any illustrations of that. One could think of that. But if it was interrupted, the Nazarite became unclean according to the law of the Lord, and there was a period wherein he had to go through, since he was unclean, he had to be made clean again, and the vow renewed, and the days prior to the interruption did not count. In other words, if he had a 45-day vow, and at 20 days he became unclean, then he just started over for 45 days after the cleansing was completed. When the time of the vow was complete, there were some things to be done. The hair of the head shaved off at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. This is looks like what was going on in Acts chapter 21 with Paul. Hair was to be burnt in a burnt offering, and they were to follow other elaborate rituals, which I didn't detail here, but the Bible describes relative to making additional sacrifices, and then they could resume their life as it was prior to the time of the vow. And that would apply to all except those who had a lifetime vow as a Nazarite. This passage is interesting for two reasons, really. It also indicates the woman could be a Nazarite, which says that a woman could shave her head at the end of that vow. And that hair had to be sacrificed just as it was for a man. There is another passage in the Old Testament that talks about a woman shaving her head and nothing of shame associated with it. That's in Deuteronomy 21, verses 10 through 14, where when Israel was to be engaged in war, and a city or a people were taken, and they were to be considered captives as opposed to devoted or destroyed, then if a man saw a woman there that he desired for a wife, he could choose her and bring her to his home. And there was a certain ritual, I would call it a ritual purification or setting apart, went on for 30 days. During that time, she was to shave her head, pare her nails, change her raiment from that of her people's to that of Israelites. And she was to mourn her parents for 30 days, and after that she could become his wife. So there are two indications of a woman shaving her head in the Old Testament. This is one of them. But the law also talks about, has a number of miscellaneous provisions mentioned as to things that were sinful and needed to be abstained from. There were sexual sins and all forms of incest. There were sins that deserved the death penalty. One of those that God truly abhorred was child sacrifice. This was so common amongst the nations round about. Also, mediums or spiritists. One who curses his parents was to be stoned. Sexual sins, blasphemer of Jehovah, and a murderer. Then there was a test that was prescribed for the woman suspected of adultery, but it could not be proven by her husband. This is the only place in the Bible where there is something that we would term a trial by ordeal. This trial would start when a husband, based on his suspicion, chooses to go to the priest and brings a special type meal offering with the suspected adulterous wife. The woman was to be brought before the priest, and the priest would require the woman to drink something the Bible defines as bitter water. Bitter water is made up as prescribed. There was water there at the temple. There was dust from the floor of, tabernacle, and dust from its floor mixed with that water, and in some way it was made bitter. The point is, the woman was to drink the water, and her guilt or innocence, which was unknown to the husband but suspected and unknown to the priest, was essentially established by God. If she was guilty, her end, the Bible describes, was pitiful. If she was found innocent, nothing happened. She was to be received as innocent and could bear children. She should not be shunned by her husband. There were more laws identified. There was to be respect for parents, laws associated with keeping of the Sabbath. I've often commented to people who talk about with Seventh-day Adventists and say we are not under the ceremonial law, but we're under the Ten Commandments. You can look at the law pertaining to the Sabbath day, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, and there is no way you can define how to keep it holy without the rest of the law. That just does not... just remembering it, keep it holy. There's no way to carry that out without God telling one how. It's interesting relative to the Lord's Supper that the Lord said in Luke chapter 22, this do. He said, remember me, but he said, this do. So he took care of that. But in the Ten Commandments, remember the Sabbath was never defined in the absence of these additional laws. There was to be no idolatry. they were to give their offerings as God prescribed, and God promised that He would accept those offerings. They were to leave corners of their fields and their vineyards and not harvest everything, every last thing in a field or vineyard. This was for the gleaners and the poor. I think I mentioned this once in a sermon I did here. My grandfather on my dad's side as a farmer in the early turn of the 1900s was a firm believer as a farmer. He never harvested everything out of his field. There were people in the community that did pick things up. If they didn't, they wouldn't have had food. So he provided for gleaners, and that law has always stuck in my mind. It was for the Jews, but it's a good thing for people who want to be considerate of the poor. There was no stealing. There was to be no false dealing with one another or lying to each other. They were not to oppress one another. There was to be no robbery, taking advantage of one another. In matters of judgment, they were to be fair and impartial. Do not slander or act against the life of someone. I'm not sure I know what that means, but I suspect it means laying traps, practicing deceit, such that you could, if someone took certain steps, put their life in danger, maybe even cost their life. If one did that, God did not approve of it. He said, do not hate, eat nothing with its blood, no divination or soothsaying. And this goes back to the mediums and spiritists. This next one is interesting. No marring of appearance. There was to be no strange cutting of hair or beard. There was to be no mutilation of oneself in grief. This is very much in contrast with the pagans round about the Israelites. The Israelites were not to have tattoo marks on their bodies. And this is something worth remembering. They were to respect the aged, reverence God, and do no wrong in their judgments and trials and courts. And in matters of commerce, they were to use true weights and balances and measures, not cheat people. So this is what God required. This is not all of the detailed law. We'll cover some more of it in this lesson, but this closes lesson 13. I guess I'd like to see if anyone's got any questions before we move on. We don't have much time for questions, and that's unfortunate, but if you got one, be happy to consider that. What we just finished. I didn't really plan to consider that. I do want to say one thing. Paul, in other words, how was the gospel revealed? Paul said in Acts chapter 20, Ephesian elders, after he had already been to Corinth, he said, I shun not to declare to you the whole counsel of God. Counsel of God, as it was, had been revealed to the apostles. There was a progressive manner in which it was written. There's no indication that there was anything progressive about its revelation. John, I believe it's chapter 16, when the Lord was ready to leave the earth, he promised the coming of the Holy Spirit or the Comforter. He said, He shall guide you into all truth. So the Spirit was provided to give them all truth. Paul was in a position to preach it and declare it. When he wrote to the Thessalonians, he said over and over to them in that writing, you know. In other words, he was referring to things he had already told them. So keep that in mind as we talk about this kind of a subject. How was this progressive in terms of Paul? Paul was a Jew. You may remember that he did not circumcise some who were with him. Timothy he took and circumcised because he was going to be with him. Made a point that he didn't have to. But he could comply with the law. So if one chose to circumcise, there was obviously nothing wrong with it under the New Testament. One chose not to, and it was appropriate not to, there was nothing wrong with that. Here in Acts chapter 18, it seems that Paul has a vow. And I want to be very clear. I don't know for sure all about what this vow was about. I have a problem with it being a Nazarite vow. It looks like it is, but here's my problem. And I've never heard this discussed. If it was a Nazarite vow, Paul partake of the Lord's. I don't have answers for all of this, bringing this up. But it's something for you to consider. Shaved his head at Cenchrea on that journey. That's clear. Travels and arrives at Jerusalem. And believe that what is going on is that vow begins at Cenchrea when he shaves his head. During this journey, He stops at several places. And when he arrives in Jerusalem and meets with the brethren, there is concern. Paul, are you teaching contrary to the law? And this is an opportunity for Paul to show that he is not opposed to these vows. He takes, and it's interesting, there are four others who have taken a similar vow. Paul's not the only one. So they go through this process, and it's at the end of the days of purification where they are staying in the temple that the Jews have the uproar and he's arrested. I only point this out for your consideration. I can't answer all the questions relative to something to think about. Any other questions? I think those are good questions, but also things we need to consider. Let's look at lesson 14. I apologize for my poor spelling. I am not a typist. I'm a Hunt and Peck typist. All of this is done in haste, and sometimes there's typos in here that I just didn't catch. But this is lesson 14. It tells us about Israel being numbered and organized. God is preparing them to become a nation. The book of Numbers gets its name from the numbering of the people. Soldiers, firstborn, Levites, and so forth. It records the occasion of two separate numberings of the people, separated by a long interval of many years. In the numbering of the people, the basis is prepared to also organize several aspects of the people, so they begin to function as a distinctive people, a special people for God. God's first census requires them to account for soldiers. They are still at Mount Sinai. It is now the first day, second month, second year after leaving Egypt. 1 month since the tabernacle was set up. Counters or census takers have been specified by God. It is to be overseen by Moses and Aaron with one man, a prince of each tribe, who will assist. I found it interesting when I looked at this that God specifically names princes of each of the tribes to help. Was God identifying the leaders of these tribes at this point? Or was he simply recognizing leaders that had already been chosen? I don't know this. But these same men are identified later for other events. Ones to be counted were identified by God, that is, all the males of Israel except the Levites, that are aged 20 and above and able to go to war, excluded the women and children and the aged and disabled men of necessity. I'd like to point out that Numbers chapter 1, verse 54 shows they had a good attitude relative to all of this census taking. No, in our country, we take censuses. Sometimes people get in an uproar as to whether they should or should not have been counted. But anyway, it says that thus did all the people according to all the Lord commanded Moses, so did they. The results of numbering soldiers. Bob has the first two columns on the left of this table. I enclosed or inserted column 3 on the right. Column 1 is the number of soldiers by tribe as detailed in Numbers chapter 1 with a total of 603,550. At the end of the wilderness wandering, the people are numbered again. The soldiers are counted, and this is just prior to crossing the Jordan at Jericho. And this number is 601,730. I just put this here for information. We'll perhaps come back to this when we cover Numbers 26. Then there's the counting of the Levites and the arrangement of the camp layout for the Israelites. The Levites are not in this first census with the soldiers because they have something else to do. They are to be put in charge of the tabernacle. They will transport and set up anew the tabernacle and all its furnishings each time the camp moves and it's resited somewhere else. Each time the camp is resited or relocated to a new site, the Levites will be required to locate their camp around their tabernacle, and there's an ordered arrangement that we will get into shortly. But they will be on all four sides around their tabernacle to keep others from coming near, lest they die and the wrath of the Lord fall upon the camp. The remainder of Israel was to be in their tents, encamped by divisions. I take that to be tribes. Each man in his own camp, under his own standard or ensign, for his own family, or, and I take that to be clan, was based on Numbers chapter 1:52. I find it interesting because it suggests that each of the tribes had a recognizable standard or ensign or banner for families that could be seen by others such that they would know where to camp, set up their tents, and form their tribal camps. The tabernacle was to always be sighted facing east towards the rising sun. Camps of the people around about will always be facing the tent of worship. In other words, everybody all around would always be looking towards the tabernacle, would always be on their mind when they, at the end of the day, and as they went about their activity through the day. Each tribal camp would follow the leadership of the same tribal prince specified by God to do the tribal census, and he names the same 12 men all over again by tribe. The layout is as follows. On the east side, in the order given, there was first Judah, then Simeon, and last Gad. And I underline Judah because this group would be known as the camp of Judah from now on. South side would be Reuben, then Simeon, and last Gad. It would be known as the camp of Reuben. West side would be Ephraim, then Manasseh, and last Benjamin. Benjamin would be the furthest away on the west side. On the north side would be Dan, then Asher, and last Naphtali. The four tribal encampment groups would move out in a specific order. Judah would be first, then Reuben, then Ephraim, then Dan. Tabernacle would be moved by the Levites in a specified order, and they would also be in the midst of the camp move. Bob has that numbered in his book. If you looked at the figure, I never could quite figure out how he numbered that sequence for us. If you do, let me know. But he indicates there was an order there. They didn't always move in the order with the tribal camp on their side. Then there are the clans of the Levites identified, and this is for purpose of getting into the discussion of the priesthood and the servants associated with the tabernacle. Levi had three sons, Gershon, who had two sons, Merari, who had two sons. Kohath had two sons, one of which was Amram. That's important because it was through Amram that the priesthood came. Amram had three children, Miriam, Moses, and Aaron. Aaron then had four sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. I struck through Nadab and Abihu because by this time we know they have died because they offered the matter of strange fire. The Levites, God called on the Levites to be presented to Aaron to be his assistants. And this is a very elaborate process. It was done at the Lord's direction. Moses brings the tribal Levi and presents them to Aaron as his assistants. But that's not enough. These men who will be charged with taking care of the furnishings and helping in fulfilling obligations associated with animals and wood for the tabernacle and so forth, these are the only Levites God will provide to be given holy to the high priest. Of all the Levites, only Aaron and his sons will serve as priests. And I'll get into this a while ago. It's not enough just to bring them. They've got to be consecrated, and we'll cover that in a moment. Next is injected in here a reason why God took the Levites as he did and gave them to be the assistants to Aaron. It begins like this, that we should remember when God struck the firstborn of Egypt. Because the Lord spared the firstborn of Israel then, he now requires it. But he will accept the Levites as his instead of the firstborn of all of Israel. But God wants this process to be fair, so he wants to account for all of the firstborn and see if there's enough Levites to take care of that. And it turns out there's not. There's only 22,000 Levite males. And there are 22,273 firstborn of Israel. So it would seem that there must be some adjustment here to compensate for this. And the way that's done is God then requires a 5-shekel levy for each one of the 273. And that tally is to then be given to Aaron. And it would seem to be for expenses associated with the tabernacle. All the Levite stock, livestock and cattle, is now given to the tabernacle this time, and this time only, in lieu of Israel's firstborn livestock. This provides for all initial animal sacrifices for Israel in the future. or in the future, Israel will sustain the tabernacle according to the law with the sacrifices it's required to make of its firstborn animals. Now the tabernacle is sustained for its worship needs as a community. It has priests, it has servants, it has livestock, and things are in order in that regard to begin the worship. But then the Levites are further organized and their duties are elaborated on. The Levites were organized by clans for encampment around the tabernacle. Moses, Aaron, and the priest were at the east end of the tabernacle where the Judah encampment was, and they were there to guard the entrance. The Gershonites were on the west side with Ephraim, the Merarites on the north side with Dan, and the Kohathites were on the south side with Reuben. The Levites are now asked to be recounted by clan as to the males that would be able to do work. Work will be allocated then by clan according to the clan's manpower that it had available to do that work. The work required would be transport of the tabernacle curtains and hangings of tabernacle and court. And they were to count men 30 to 50 years of age to do that work. Other non-priest associated work with the tabernacle, as I mentioned already, animals and wood to be collected, things like that. And there may have been a number of those things. This would be men 25 to 50 years of age. Well, after they numbered these people by clans, they then allocated to the Gershonites, based on their manpower, the duty to transport the curtains, the hangings of the tabernacle, and the court. You may remember that during the days of the consecration of the priests, the princes came and gave wagons and oxen. Now these are assigned to the Levites. They are given two wagons, two oxen, and they are to be supervised in their activities and transport, taken down, transporting there to be supervised by Ithamar. Kohathites were given the responsibility for care of the furniture within the tabernacle. They were to transport the ark, the altar of incense, the candlestick, table of showbread, the altar of burnt offering. And I inserted this note because Bob mentioned it. I thought it was a good one. The Bible does indicate at times that the priests who were Kohathites carried the ark. But it seems that here the Kohathites would carry the ark. It wasn't always necessary the priests do it. Special steps were required to prepare for and to transport these items, and all were to be carried on the shoulders via staves inserted in rings or in prepared hanging cloths or bags that were on poles carried on the shoulders. No wagons or carts were to be used. And this really brings up the issue of David and the ark and Uzzah and them putting it on the ox cart. Eleazar is in charge of this movement. And by the way, when David moved the Ark of the Covenant as he did, Levites should have been the first to have known how it was to be carried. They carry the primary responsibility, I believe, for what happened there in that incident. The Merarites were to transport the boards associated with the tabernacle. These were large and numerous, silver and bronze sockets, which were numerous and quite heavy, tent stakes and cords, pillars of the tabernacle, posts of the courtyards. They were given four wagons and eight oxen. Ithamar is in charge of this process. Now, for these people that were not priests to begin to do their work, they needed to be consecrated. They were counted and organized for their work, as we've mentioned, and they needed to be consecrated so they could be ceremonially clean and set apart for the work they had to do before God and the people. I think that there was perhaps something here to get the people to understand these people were no longer common and ordinary. They had special work to do, and they were to be respected. And this whole process brings this to the attention of the Israelites. Well, God specified this consecration process. It begins with sprinkling the water of purification. They were to shave their bodies, wash their clothes, bring two bulls with grain offering, assemble all and present before the Lord at the tent of meeting. The sons or princes of Israel were to lay their hands on them. And I think this indicates they were approving of this and participating in this process with their attitude and their giving. But they were to do this, and it was to be as a wave offering on their part. Aaron then presents the Levites to the Lord, and it's done again as a wave offering. Then there is a sin offering to be made using one of the bulls that was brought, and a burnt offering using the other bull, and there's more that goes on. But when this is over, the Levites are separated from the sons of Israel, and they're now consecrated to their work. There were some rules for the priest. They were not to defile themselves with the dead except for, this is the priest other than the high priest. I want to make that clear. They were not to defile themselves for the dead except for the nearest blood relative. A relative by marriage was not even bitter. They must not mar themselves by cutting hair or beard for the dead. They must be holy. They must not profane the name of God. I think that this profaning the name of God likely refers to not just cursing the name of God, but using God's name in a vain way, suggesting to the people, this is what God wants you to do, this is what God said, when in fact God hadn't said it and didn't do it. That would also be a profaning, and that's made very clear in the book of Jeremiah, that to speak as though they had instructions from God or God required something when he did not would be a profaning as well. Be holy because they present offerings before God. They were not to marry a profane woman, that is one from harlotry or one divorced, even if the one from harlotry had repented. You may remember that it was married Rahab. But this is obviously not a sin to marry one if there was repentance involved. But in the case of a priest, he still couldn't do that. If the priest's daughter is a harlot, becomes a harlot, she must be burned. Remember that adulterers were stoned. But here, because she's a priest's daughter, she is to be burned. Regarding physical defects and service as priest, there would be none that were blind, lame, disfigured in face, and the King James says having his nose flattened. I don't know where Bob got this phrase, disfigured in face, but you can generalize, I guess. Having deformed limbs, broken bones, and I take this to be bones, not, this was the extremities, feet and hands, I believe. Hunchback, a dwarf, one blemished in the eye, eczema, scabs, crushed testicles. Note, these conditions, though disqualifying per se, are not sinful in and of themselves. Such a Levite could share in eating holy things, he just could not serve as a priest. Now, for the high priest, there was something else required. He must not uncover his head and tear clothes or approach a dead person. In our society, for instance, if we, in certain situations, men wearing hats will take them off when a casket comes by or something, or stand by the road as a funeral procession goes by and they take their hat off. He could not uncover his head, even, if there was a matter of a dead person, not even for a blood relative. Shall not go out of the sanctuary or profane it. I'm not sure what this refers to. If anybody's got any ideas, I'd be happy to hear them. I took it to mean that while doing his duties and going about his activities, the high priest, when he went in to do something, should not interrupt it to go out to take care of something ordinary, then go back and resume his duties. But that's just a guess. Wife must be a virgin of the people of Israel. And then we're told in Ezekiel that he could marry a widow if she was a widow of a priest. Now, it didn't say a widow of a high priest. She was a widow of a priest, he could marry a widow. Now, why were the Levites chosen as special? These are some things that are worth remembering. Moses and Aaron, who were of the tribe of Levi, chosen by God as the first leaders. Aaron and two of his sons were with the 70 that went up for the meal before the Lord, recorded in Exodus 24 at Mount Sinai. At the time of the first instructions given for preparing priestly garments, it was said they would be for Aaron and his sons. but maybe most important at Mount Sinai, when Israel sinned with a golden calf, Moses asked who is on the Lord's side, and it was the Levites who joined Moses and drew their swords and helped bring an end to the sin that was in the camp. It was in Deuteronomy 9 and verse 10, Moses in his last speeches says that it was at Mount Horeb in regarding this business of the golden calf that God said then he was setting apart the tribe to one, bear the ark, and two, stand before the Lord. Then how does a camp move? Had to be organized such that they would respond to signals for actions. There were the cloud signals, cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. When it moved, they moved. When it stopped, they stopped, set up camp. Silver trumpets, two trumpets were made from beaten silver and used to signal sound alarms for the camp, such as to assemble, to call the leaders, to tell them it was time to move out, they were now ready, or in time of war, when they were being attacked, to call on the Lord to remember them and save them, and for blowing at feast times, such as new moon festivals and over special sacrifices. And go back and look at these feast times and new moons, you'll see these mentioned. If I recall, Bob did a sermon on these two trumpets. We are not going to finish this lesson either, but Lord willing, we will Wednesday. That was the second bell. We'll pick up here with part 12 and finish this Wednesday. James?